The following is an audio podcast from the Korea Society, celebrating more than a half century of promoting awareness, understanding, and cooperation between the people of the United States and Korea. For more information on our programs, please visit our website at www.koreasociety.org. This podcast is brought to you through the generous financial support of the Tongyang Group. In the areas of financial services and manufacturing, the companies of the Tongyang Group harness the passion and creativity of 12,000 employees worldwide to better serve their clients. The Tongyang Group, a global partner for Korean business.
On August 10, 2010, Dr. John Gould, professor of religion and director of the Asian Studies program at Sweetbriar College, spoke at the Korea Society to middle and high school teachers as part of the New York City Department of Education's after-school professional development program. Dr. Gould specializes in the sociology, religion, and culture of North and South Korea. He received a bachelor's degree from Seoul National University and completed his graduate work at Harvard University. In this first of two lectures, Dr. Gould addresses traditional thought and values in Korea.
Well, thank you very much. I always love coming to New York, but not much else. So it'd be nice to come back to a big city in our retirement. Okay. Also, let me tell you a little bit about myself. I'm trained in the sociology of religion. That is to say that when I look at religion, I'm not really looking at what people are saying. That's important, but I'm really interested in knowing why people are religious. How does religion function within people's lives? In other words, if religion has any purpose, clearly it helps people, but it also helps communities. And religion, by definition, is a communal phenomenon. You can't be religious alone. Just one person cannot be religious. It's always somebody within a community. And so in my study of Korean religions and philosophy, I've always asked the question, what does this mean? What relevance does this have for the historical circumstances of the time? And I think you'll see that in the present way I present religions, primarily as cultural phenomenon, social phenomenon, and the kinds of effects they've had on communities, both within the Korean Peninsula as well as outside the Korean Peninsula. Okay, let's begin. Religion in Korea has played a critical role in the development of Korean culture and identity. As members of the U.S. society, we too think that religion is important. After all, most people would argue that without Christianity, we would not have the kind of democracy that we have today. That religion does function in a way of providing people both with values as well as challenges. There's another aspect about religion that we should call to mind, is that religion is, in fact, dynamic. Religions are not static. They aren't just a set of ideas that people have and then carry from one generation to the other. But religions really do change. According to the circumstances of the time, people will change and adapt their religions. So religions provide people with a kind of model of what they should be, as well as they're able to deal with new circumstances. The story of religions in Korea is also the story of how Koreans have adapted to the larger world around them. Yesterday, you had an overview of Korean history, and one of the indisputable facts of Korean culture and history is that Koreans found themselves caught between very large, powerful neighbors. China on the one side, Japan, other nations on the other side, and Koreans really had to adapt to that circumstance all throughout their history. Korea, of course, adopted the religions of China, including Confucianism, Buddhism, Taoism, Korea also adopted the religions of Islam. There are now three very large mosques in Seoul. The total number of Muslims within Korea is not that many, but the religion is present, and Koreans now are beginning to create a heritage of it. Christianity is also very important in Korea, especially in the 19th and 20th century, and sociologists and historians have pointed that Christianity in Korea often functions as a kind of ideology of the modern world, helping Koreans to adapt to what they see across the globe. Another function of religions in Korea is that it is through religious groups, organizations, structures, that Koreans can identify themselves with others. For example, Buddhism, which came originally from India, then to China, and then to Korea, actually helped Koreans to think about other people. They weren't confined to understanding Buddhism only in the peninsula, but also Buddhism in China, Buddhism in India. And many Korean Buddhists would travel outside the country in order to make contact with other Buddhists. The same thing for Christianity, great 19th century missionary movement. This introduced a lot of Koreans to Western culture, Western technology of the 19th and 20th centuries. And of course, after a period of missionization, many Koreans left Korea to go out and see the rest of the world. And they primarily did it through channels that were open to them because they were Christian. Right. So Korean language, the religions of Korea have helped Koreans to form their culture, form their identity, but also kept them in touch with the rest of the world. So that religions really have a kind of transnational purpose. If we look at religions, I think you've read about that. There are basically three types of religions within Korea. The first are the transnational or global religions. What I mean by transnational is that religions and their teachings, their organizations, the values that they have, come from one place, but they move to another place. So they cross the borders of between China and Korea, or China between Korea and Japan. We include within the transnational religions the religions of Confucianism, Buddhism, Taoism. We also include Christianity and Islam. Obviously, these five religions aren't just the product of Korean imagination. They, in fact, have a history elsewhere, and Koreans have adopted them over a period of time. Confucianism, Buddhism, Taoism, Christianity, Islam share characteristics that are they're very similar. That is, they tend to be universalistic, so that it's not just important to be a Korean Buddhist, but it's important to be a Buddhist. And Buddhists share a kind of outlook on the world, a way of explaining cause and effect within the world, a way of explaining the value of life or the value of death in a way that is very similar, no matter where the religion is present. Confucianism, another global religion, introduced very early on, and this is the interesting point, it was actually introduced by Buddhists. Buddhists brought Confucian texts to Korea and actually taught them over the years, is a religion that is primarily geared to social organization. 19th century philosophers and religious historians have referred to Confucianism as a socio-political ethic that informs the development of states, their organs of government, and also helps to inform how families are organized at the societal level. So Confucianism's values deal with the importance of the family, parent-child relations, keeping family solidarity together, being loyal to those who are closest to you. Confucianism also, as a transnational religion, emphasizes the idea that people should work together at a national level. That is, you are loyal to a king or to a government, so that everyone can look out for the welfare of others. The third religion is Taoism. Though Taoism is not usually described as being predominant in religion, we do find it in Korea. Taoism is a religion really about one's own self, much more individualistic than either Confucianism or Buddhism is. And Taoism in Korea really developed into a tradition of health foods, exercise, taking care of one's body, meditating, abstaining from certain practices as well as certain foods in order to change one's life, literally one's physical life, so that one can live to a very long for a long period of time, and in some instances actually transform oneself into an immortal. And Koreans did actually focus, when they adopted Taoism, they liked the idea of living off in the countryside, eating a very restricted diet, spending lots of time in meditation, purifying the mind, purifying the body as a way of living long times. And Korea has a lot of stories about Korean immortals and how they went about accomplishing that. Christianity is the fourth global religion, and of course it is the product of missionary activity first in China and then later in Korea. Way back in the 17th century, missionaries from Europe, of course, had appeared in China. They had brought the traditions of Western culture, science, technology, and religion to China, and much of that information had been translated into Chinese classical writing. Koreans first encountered those writings as early as the beginnings of the 18th century, and they brought back books about Christianity as well as Western subjects, and they decided to implement it. Korea has the rare distinction of being the only country in Asia where Catholicism was established by books rather than by missionaries. So Koreans read books on Christian doctrine, and they decided, okay, we'll baptize each other, we'll set up churches, we'll ordain priests, and we'll elect bishops, and they did so for almost 50 years. That is, that they had no foreign missionary there. They used the books as a means of establishing Catholicism. Later on in the 19th century, missionaries did enter into Korea, primarily Protestant, and then Christianity spread. But Korea stands out as an Asian country that has readily adapted itself and adopted Christianity. And finally, the fifth religion is the one that is also a new religion here in the United States, that is Islam. Beginning actually all the way back in the 1940s, Koreans living in North Korea had come in contact with Muslims in China. There had been a community that had converted to Islam. Later on, after the division of the Korean Peninsula, some of those Muslims in North Korea came south. And then in the 60s and 70s, as Koreans moved out into the world, they encountered Islam again and brought back Islam as a viable religious option within Korea itself. The Islam is pluralistic Islam. It's not particularly Shiite or Sunni. And in fact, it's very much a kind of globalized form of Islam that we don't find elsewhere. Okay, so those are the transnational global religions. Looking at the word transnational, always keep in mind that that means that Koreans feel connected with people other than Koreans. They know that there are Muslims, Taoists, Christians, and so forth elsewhere, and they are, in fact, really connect themselves to it. The second type of religion are what I call local indigenous religions. Koreans have a word for describing early and archaic religious practices in Korea. They call it musok, M-U-S-O-K. The word itself is a strange word because it combines two ideas. Religions related to mediums, that's what mu means, spirit mediums or shamans, people who go into trance and contact the dead, people who go into trance and contact familiar spirits, people who can control everything from, what do we call them, tokebi? Wandering ghosts, various types of powers and spirits and so forth. And then sok is the word that means we would translate it as folk practices. We'll refer to sok religions, religions that have a kind of folk practice, has to do with the avoidance, certain taboos that Koreans have always held, rituals to prevent calamity, fortune-telling, astrological projections, dealing with baleful days, baleful stars, avoiding a lot of avoidance rituals. And again, these have been transmitted into Korea, all throughout Korean history, and they're still present in today. What's interesting now is that celebrants or officiants of this indigenous religion now advertise with neon signs. So you can walk around Seoul and see a nice neon sign blinking off in the corner, come have your fortune told, or, you know, $10, you can find out who your marriage partner will be, or how much money can you make in the next year, and so forth, come in and it will tell you how to do that. We also have shaman religious practices that are a part of this, and while these are not very well organized, there's no big one institution, there's really no set of scriptures that people follow, Nevertheless, this has an appeal to Koreans. Koreans, even though they might be Christian, Confucian, Buddhist, or Muslim, still also participate in indigenous practices. And so, you know, people go out for dinner, they'll tell each other's fortune. Or when they meet each other for the first time, they immediately ask them, well, what's your sign? Under what sign did you were you born? And so for a long time in Korea, they used to ask me how old I was. Well, I tell them, I was born in the year of the ox. Okay, so immediately they know who I am because they can discern from the year of my birth what my characteristics, internal reactions are going to be, emotional makeup, and so forth. These indigenous beliefs and practices that actually persist, and they persist alongside other religions. So people are Christian, but that doesn't mean that they don't patronize shamans. People might be Buddhist, but they will also pray to local spirits, and inevitably they'll put charms in their household, little paper charms that will prevent calamities from happening and so forth. And of course, when people get sick, prior to the introduction of Western medicine, the indigenous religious practitioners were the ones who had control over medicine. So they would go to a shaman healer or some other type of healer who would in fact administer folk remedies. And that's, again, even today, people will often trust folk remedies over more modern forms of medicine and care. The third type of religions here are what I would call syncretistic new religions that begin in the 19th century and are continuing to be produced in the 20th century. By syncretistic, I mean that they borrow elements from other religions. So there are, for example, in Cheollado province, the area referred to as Kiryongsan, the Kiryongsan region, there are something like 300 different small communities located around a sacred mountain. And each of these new communities, beginning in the 19th century, continuing on into the present, is an amalgamation of something. An amalgamation of Buddhist ideas, Confucian ideas, Christian ideas, modern ideas, indigenous ideas, where people, in fact, join together to practice a religion, to carry out rituals of purification and rituals for happiness based upon the fact that they are different from other kinds of Koreans. They aren't exclusively Buddhist. They're not exclusively Confucian, but they can participate in all of them. So syncretistic religions, very new religions and so forth, appeal, especially in the 19th and 20th century, to Koreans who are interested in not being confined to one group. All right. One of the aspects about global religions is they expect you to be kind of exclusively Buddhist or exclusively Christian. And Koreans don't like that. They don't like having to be confined to one tradition alone. Koreans, for a lot of political and historical reasons, are a little bit afraid of religious groups because they tend to be dictatorial. Much of Korean history is actually a conflict between people and their government. Government gets too overbearing, Koreans revolt, choose different ways of dealing with the world. And so the same thing with religious organizations. They can become very confining, and Koreans inevitably try to break out from that if they ever become a part of it. Okay. So we have these three types of religions. This is my classification. Many people would classify religions other that way, but I wanted to highlight the fact that religions can start in Korea. They can also come from elsewhere into Korea, and of course, they can be something new and novel. I think most of you are acquainted with, for example, the Unification Church of Munsonmyeong. This is a 20th century syncretistic religion. It's a religion very much like Unitarian Universalism. Everything, they believe everything. Everything in the world is relevant and important to members of the Unification Church. And that church actually has now spread across the globe and is competing in the marketplace of religions along with other types of religions. There's also, I don't know if any of you are acquainted with Baha'i, which was a development of Indian Sufism, along with Indian traditions, and Baha'i religion, of course, maybe not as popular as it was in the past, also has the kind of universalistic, transnational focus. Okay? Finally, one last comment on the notion of the syncretistic religions. the 19th and 20th centuries are different from the global and the indigenous in that the ideas that are present in these new religions are very modern ideas. The whole idea of national identity, secure national security, the idea of competition between nations and how to deal with that, the idea of development, especially economic development, capitalist development, these are firmly the kinds of issues that the new religions deal with. Do you have to be religious and give up money? No, obviously not. If you are religious, do you in fact have to follow old customs? No, you can follow new customs. Does it mean when you are a member of one of these new religions, are you very Korean? The whole issue of ethno-nationalism. And the new religions deal with the question of Korean tradition and history and so forth in some ways that the transnational global religions do not. Okay? All three types of religion, though, of course, have helped Koreans to identify themselves, to give them a set of ideas, values, and a kind of worldview. Okay? We'll move on real briefly to talk a little bit about the function of religions in Korea. And I'll focus primarily on how religions in the past have helped Koreans to develop their own society and culture. The global religions were introduced into the peninsula as a part of early diplomatic trade relations that Korea established with China in the first centuries of the Common Era. And then later in the 19th century, with interaction between Korea and the West, and in the 20th century between Korea and Islamic Near East. The introduction of the religions of Buddhism, Confucianism, and Taoism occurred during a period in which Koreans themselves were just beginning to form nation states. That is, instead of having independent colonies or communities of Koreans living on the peninsula, people were actually beginning to join together for the sake of mutual defense, for the sake of establishing a single government, and this occurs around the beginnings of the Common Era. Influence from China at this time helped Koreans to actually come to the idea that they needed a king. A king is a ruler, a king is in charge, a king is benevolent, and so forth. And the religious information that came from China at the time helped Koreans to create kingdoms and then to establish governments. One of the primary concepts introduced into Korea as part of their relations with China was the idea that government is benevolent. So whatever kingdoms were created in the first centuries, that the king was primarily considered to be a father figure. He was there to take care of people, to prevent people from suffering greatly, and therefore was in charge of everything. The king was responsible for the calendar. The king was responsible for crops, for rotating the calendar so that crops are harvested at the right time and then food is stored and so forth. The king also, of course, was also responsible for taxation. That is, he had to raise funds to protect the country against invaders or organizing people into self-policing units so that, in fact, the evil that most of us are prone to doesn't become an issue within society itself. Where did the Koreans get that? They got the idea from China. China was a relatively well-organized society, had been so for almost 1,000 years, and Koreans went to China, saw the society, recognized how it operated, and brought back the lessons to their own peninsula. And thus, in the Three Kingdoms period, first through the 7th centuries, both Confucianism and Buddhism were very important as a way of helping Koreans to organize the society. Remember also that at this time, contrary to the modern experience, religion is a function of government. We don't often think of that. We who live in the United States actually prefer to have religion as a function of the individual rather than the government. After all, we don't want the government telling us what the nature of the cosmos is. Right? We don't want the government to tell us what we can and cannot do. We actually want to tell the government what they can and cannot do. And we certainly don't believe that religion primarily is mandated by law. Our Constitution is based upon the separation between religious adherence and citizenship. But in Korea at this time, and actually in the rest of the world at the same time, religion had to be supported by the government. Without government support, there could be no religious ideas, practices, or institutions. And in Korea, from the 1st to the 7th century, it was the role of kings and queens to, in fact, promote religion. They were also in charge of religion. They were responsible for making sure that religious groups worked for the good of society and that they, in fact, operated in a way that did not cause problems. And so when we look at the early history of the transnational groups within Korea, we clearly see something that is top-down. The government controls, limits, and prescribes, periodically reforms, as well as helps to propagate a religious outlook. Why does the government need to do this? Anyone want to? Why do governments need to do that? They want loyalty. They want people to be loyal to them as an authority. And religious ideology is often a way of inducing loyalty. So, for example, can anyone give examples of how religion, say, in the United States, induces loyalty to the state? Think of a cliche, you know, guns, butter, and God, right? Food, you know, independence, whatever. Motherhood, the flag, and God bless America, where religion is actually used as kind of popular cliche to induce loyalty to the state. And many religious groups in the United States, of course, promote loyalty to the state. Being law-abiding, that's a religious function. Not just that you follow religious laws, but you also follow civil laws. The same thing is true in Korea. Religion really functioned as a way of instructing people how they should operate within society and giving them the means for creating social relationships. The first religion actually to be adopted in Korea is Confucianism. If you've done any work on Confucianism and elsewhere, Confucianism is a tradition of ideas, values, social structures, and rituals developed actually long before Confucius himself appeared. During the Zhou Dynasty, 12th century BCE, they developed a whole series of classic rituals and ideas and philosophies in China during the Zhou period. And later, that period, things worked out very well. When Confucius was born, he looked back to the period of the Zhou and said, if we could return to that kind of society, that would be great. And so when Confucius taught his disciples the best form of government, the best form of family, the best form of religious piety, the role of propriety and decorum in society, all of these values, he primarily based his teachings on the teachings or the traditions of the Zhou Dynasty. It's also not irrelevant that the fact that Confucius claimed that he was, in fact, a descendant of the first minister of Zhou, the Duke of Zhou, who was, in fact, sort of in charge of the government at the time, and so Confucius wanted to keep his own family tradition alive. In China, Confucianism really was an outlook, both a philosophy as well as a set of religious practices, in which all members of society are taught that society works best when everyone works for the sake of society's good, i.e., that society should be organized on the principle of the common good. Throughout the writings of Confucius and his disciples, they are constantly talking about the fact that a good person is one who puts the welfare of the community above his own welfare or her own welfare. That the good of the family is greater than the good of the individual. The good of all families together in a state is greater than that of any particular family. And the relationships between people living in an organized state is that they should, in fact, be exercise propriety and courtesy. Any of you acquainted with a young or not so young woman, Judith Martin? Anyone know Judith Martin? Miss Manners? Anyone know, recognize the name? Yeah, Miss Manners, yeah. Miss Manners' philosophy, as we see it printed in newspapers every day, is that, you do things so that people can get along. You always consider the good of the community over the good of the particular good that you want to fulfill. Confucianism does the same thing. Propriety and courtesy, just being civil to one another, is considered very important. If you don't act in a civil and courteous manner in society, then societies will fall apart. Confucius also laid out a program for how you could learn, how you could teach people to, in fact, exercise this notion of civility and propriety and decorum in society at large. And he primarily emphasized the training of young children from a very early age in relationship to their parents. So children from a young age learn to deal with their parents that will become the template for dealing with others outside the family. So as long as a child recognizes the authority of the parents, learns to be loyal to the parents and to have reverence for the parents, then when that child moves out into society, they will have the same attitude towards others, especially people who are older in society. This translated into an ideology in the first century, into an ideology of actually the Chinese government itself. During the Han Dynasty, the Chinese imperial government adopted Confucian values as a way of keeping society well organized. And Koreans were exposed to the Han Dynasty form of government. They brought back from China after visiting it, again, classical Confucian texts about filial piety, classical Confucian texts about the role of government in society, classical Confucian texts about the nature of the universe, how the universe itself reflects a kind of order. Practically, it actually does work. There should be a kind of distinction between parents and children. Well, Confucianism actually emphasizes this distinction, that not all of us are equal. But learning that we're not equal is actually a good thing, because when we move out into society beyond that of the family, we will, in fact, learn to deal with people at different ages, different statuses. Okay. Another aspect about Confucianism that it was adopted by the Koreans was that the idea that government, especially the offices of government, should be based upon not who has the strongest arm, who are the people who run government, not the strong, but the best educated. And Chinese had already developed a system by which its own government employees would be tested on their knowledge of the values of Confucianism, the texts of Confucianism, and they would be tested periodically in order to gain government status. In the Han Dynasty, Chinese believed that it was the educated who should, in fact, run the government, not the uneducated, not the self-interested. And Confucianism was the way of turning self-interested individuals into public-minded individuals. And Koreans also adopted this. They liked the idea that the people who are going to collect the taxes, the people who are going to enforce the laws, the people who are going to help with the harvest, the people who are going to create the public roads, the people who are going to defend the borders, all these functionaries within government would have been trained in the ideology of Confucius, so that they would always put the public good ahead of their own good. Of course, that's the ideal. And Koreans always believed that the ideal was possible. History tells us that the ideal wasn't always there. Confucians sometimes were very greedy, and sometimes they were not so public-minded and so forth. But nevertheless, the idea of government as government by the meritorious and those who are trained to work in government did take hold. And then finally, a third aspect of the introduction of Confucianism was the notion of that Koreans, like Chinese, like others, all are under the authority of heaven. A very important idea, that there is a great power in the universe called heaven. And heaven is both the physical sky and a kind of moral power that, in fact, establishes what we today call the laws of nature. Heaven is that power that sets out the patterns of change and time and development. Therefore, we cannot act and live in the world willy-nilly. We actually have to follow a kind of rational lifestyle that conforms to differences that heaven and the earth display. Obviously, we're not going to eat, summer fruit in winter or spring fruit in fall. You're going to eat the food that's available at the time you want it. or you have it. We're not going to dress, you know, in heavy woolen clothing in the middle of a New York summer heat wave, nor are we going to dress, you know, in summer shorts in the middle of winter. So if there is a standard pattern to the life that we live, it must somehow be reflected in our environment. And Confucianism really taught the idea that we should take our cue from the way the world operates, how it operates. And this is a kind of, I call it proto-rationalism, that, you know, there are principles of the universe that we cannot ignore when we live. And so in Confucian writings about government, there's a constant emphasis on the fact that rulers must be timely. They should follow the circumstances of the present, not have one policy that applies at all times, but should be adapted to changing circumstances. Just as the agricultural calendar changes, so government itself should change. This notion that somehow or other this ruling authority of heaven is there was very important. Why? The idea that heaven is important and has created a universe that has order to it is the basis on which we believe that order can exist. If there's no possibility of order in the universe, then we cannot have a society. And Confucianism taught everywhere that it appeared the idea that order is not only possible, but it's already manifest in the world around us. And the order of the universe is also a reflection of the order of the family, the order of the nation state, the order of interpersonal relations among human beings, and so forth. And then finally, the last very important value introduced into Korea was the love of book learning. When I was in Korea back in the early 60s, I was amazed to watch students do everything to protect the books they owned. It might be raining. Students would not put their book on top of their head to keep them dry. They would actually take a book and put it inside their clothing to keep it dry. In the instances of Confucianism, Taoism, even Buddhism, it was the medium of books that attracted Koreans to religion. That is, because there was a scripture, and the scripture was written in a language they could understand, they were attracted to the ideas. No place else do we find this. A little bit in South China sometimes, and periodically in Japan, but Koreans really have this obsession with books. They read a lot. They read a lot all the time. Not modern Koreans recently. I was in Seoul a couple weeks back, and I didn't see a lot of students reading books, but I saw a lot of people doing texts, right? Which is another kind of book, I guess. It's a very short book, but they were doing texts and so forth. But the Confucian idea that book learning makes you human, more knowing books, reading books, memorizing books, being able to quote from books, this is really a desideratum. It's a desirable quality of Korean, both personal and social identity. Is established with Confucianism. And even today, while many Koreans no longer follow Confucian values, nevertheless, they still have this lingering nostalgia about the scholar. And the scholars are to be honored. You don't pay them well, but you at least honor them. And being a teacher is actually considered to be quite honorable, even in the modern day. Wish we could import that here to the United States and then get the salaries up, but it's there already in Korea. Okay, Confucianism generally then, as it was introduced and practiced, exerts pressure today, as it did in the past, in really creating a great reverence for culture itself. That is, Koreans like the idea of refined culture, refined music, refined art, refined writing, because Confucianism is really about the promotion of refined culture, that we are not like the four-footed, six-footed things around us. We are not animals. We are educated. We have ordered emotions. We are not wild like other kinds of animals in the world. Okay, and then finally, of course, and this is important, Confucianism actually had another function in Korea in that it helped Koreans defend themselves. Anyone here heard of the Mandate of Heaven? Okay, the Mandate of Heaven says, anyone? Ever heard that phrase, Mandate of Heaven? Well, the mandate of heaven refers to a Confucian idea that those who have acquired power must have been destined to get that power, otherwise they wouldn't have it. They have a clear mandate to rule because they rule. And in China, as well as in Japan, the mandate actually referred to a kind of contract between people and their government. Those who had a mandate to rule had the support of the people. When the people did no longer support their rulers, then the mandate was lost. Okay? Yeah. It's divine right in one regard, in the sense that the rulers who are who have been mandated by heaven to rule have the right to demand loyalty. But at the same time, they can lose the mandate. So that means they have to be very cautious about their ruler, how they rule. Actually, it's real clear. Confucius, Mencius, and his disciples all said, when the people are unhappy, then the mandate's gone. So, again, it's the idea that really how society fares is really the criterion by which we judge who will have power and who will not have power. Right? Very famous phrase by Mencius says, I never heard of the assassination of a bad king. And it's an interesting phrase. Even though kings have been assassinated all over the world, he said, I never heard of an assassination of a bad king. Why? By definition, a bad king is no longer a king. Therefore, when you kill him, you're not assassinating him. He's no longer a king, right? So that you can, and this is principle Koreans understood very well, that governments, if they fail to take care of the people, then you can kill the king willy-nilly, do whatever you want. That's fine. And ultimately, it's the people who decide whether, in fact, the mandate exists or not. The mandate, though, has another international meaning, and this refers to the relationship between China and its neighbors. According to Confucian theory, China is the great power, and according to Confucius, that country which is most refined, has the truth, is the standard, has an obligation to other nation states. The first obligation is to civilize them, okay, and the second obligation is to protect them. So because Koreans set up relations with China and established Confucian institutions, and demonstrated to the Chinese that they had, then the Chinese had a mandate to protect Korea. And all throughout Korean history, that allowed the Koreans to actually rule in their own right. The Chinese never came in and took over Korea. And it also meant that in times of national disaster, Koreans could rely upon the Chinese to come in and protect them. Okay? 18 times in Korean history, the Korean government has gone to China and asked them to come and protect the country. Okay? This also meant that China could never station troops within Korea unless they were requested. So the mandate allowed Korea to actually develop as its own independent state, but have the security arrangements of China extended to them. In order to earn that mandate to be independent and to be secure, Koreans had to demonstrate that they were civilized. They were worthy of protection. And so institutions of Confucianism were set up. People were sent to China to take exams, to make contacts with the Chinese government on all levels and so forth. And after a time, China began to recognize that Korea was a good place. It was a civilized place. The people who lived there were well-educated. They were well-mannered. And therefore, they were worthy of protection. Okay, so that's important. And actually, even though some Koreans might think that they were invaded by China all the time, actually China preserved Korean independence because the Chinese always considered that Koreans were educated. They were worthy of protection. So what today we would call an alliance. In other words, the alliance that protects a lot of countries with the U.S. or Russia, these alliances actually secure people's independent right to exist. And in Asian history, China extended that sense of protection and agreement to countries that emulated it. So if a country established institutions of Confucianism, Buddhism, Taoism, and so forth, then China would always protect that country. So, I mean, the Koreans benefited from adopting Confucianism in that they suddenly got a protector. They also had to pay for it. That is, Chinese kept demanding furs and
agricultural products. Things had to be sent to the Chinese government every year as a way of ensuring their loyalty and so forth. Okay, let's move on to Taoism real quickly. Taoism is another Chinese religion introduced in the peninsula in the first century. In China, Taoism had developed as a religion that dealt with the question of how to control the forces of the universe, which we know today as yin and yang. That is, that human beings, their happiness and their long life is dependent upon the ability of human beings to control how much energy is expended and in what ways it is expended. Early Taoist scriptures talk about the need to conserve energy, to not overtax the body, to use appropriate foods that will in fact allow the body to live a long natural life. Taoist scriptures of the early period also talk about the need to get away from complicated society, go out into the woods, live naturally, live like animals, adapt yourself to the natural environment. And in such quietude, Taoists argue, human beings would establish within themselves a kind of mental and physical balance. And once they had acquired that balance, then it would become very natural for them to live to at least 120 years. In all Taoist scriptures, the natural lifespan should be 120 years. Right? Most people don't live that long, but the Taoists believe that this was possible. That if the body were well regulated, the mind didn't interfere with the body's own workings, that in fact people would live a very happy and well-controlled life till their 120th year. Taoists also proposed that such a balance could actually be turned into transcendence. You could learn to escape the body and continue to live even after the body died as some sort of transcendent or immortal. And Taoists developed techniques, rituals, texts that help them to in fact transform the body. Very common expression in China, also in Korea, is that, you know, Taoists are the people who know how to keep their hair black. They don't age quickly. Right? And they keep their muscles flexible and soft. They don't get wrinkly and leathery and so forth because they have a very balanced approach to life. And again, those of you who are into yoga or some sort of physical exercise and so forth, we do the same thing. We exercise the body not because we want the body to be hard, but we want the body to be soft. Right? We do a lot of, you know, pumping iron, running and so forth, to keep the joints soft rather than to have them become calcified. Right? Taoists have the same idea. They have gymnastic programs, meditation programs, all kinds of exercises that will actually keep the body soft and supple so that it will last longer. And the ideal, of course, is that ultimately all Chinese Taoists or Taoists, wherever they are, will in fact be like children. Their complexion will be like that of a child. Age will not force itself upon their skin and so forth, and they will live very long life. If they're lucky, they can even become transcendent immortals within the body and live along with the rest of the universe forever. In China, though, Taoism had been well organized into a series of sects along with priests, rituals, and temples. Koreans never actually knew anything about this, but they got the books. And Taoist books were brought into China, into Korea, as early as the 2nd century. And the Koreans liked the ideas that were contained in them, and they began to practice Taoism. But not because Taoist priests came in and taught them, but they had Taoist books. So they read a book about Taoist rituals, and they practiced it. Or they adapted it to their own needs. Chinese Taoism, and even the Chinese remarked about this in the 12th century, that the Koreans know Taoist cosmology, they know Taoist medicine, alchemy, Taoist philosophy very well, but they don't have any Taoist practitioners, or what they call Taoist priests. And Koreans never did. They never developed the institution of the Taoist priesthood, even though individual Koreans did practice Taoism. Right? The value of Taoism, again, was that Taoism, at least in the Korean eyes, was a way of dealing with the big macrocosmic forces. Taoists taught Koreans to develop very precise calendars so that they knew exactly what the movements of the stars and planets would be, and thus they would be able to calculate when the first frost occurred, when the solstices would occur, when the stars would be in juxtaposition that would be lucky, or when they would be in a position when they were unlucky. And Taoists really said that the clue to happiness really exists already in the macrocosm, not some sort of a microcosm of human imagination. So you constantly are attuned to what's going on in the natural world, and you live according to that, then in fact you will be happy. One of the practices that appears in the 11th century in Korea, based upon Taoism, is something also that has appeared here in New York, actually all over the world, feng shui, geomancy, the idea of how you situate your house, how you situate your room, how you situate your furniture, how you orient yourself to literally the north, south, east, west orientation of the universe itself. Geomancy was very important for Koreans because they adopted, like the Chinese, an idea that everything should face south. So that when you sleep facing east, your feet are in the south. When you turn left, you always sleep on your left side, so that you'll be in tune with the rotation of the earth. So a lot of principles of geomancy and feng shui that allow Koreans to, in fact, maximize or at least attune their own bodies to what was going on in the universe itself. Chinese also introduced into Korea macrobiotics, the certain food avoidances, how to avoid certain foods. Koreans love meat, if they can't get enough meat. But the Taoists, of course, taught them that it's better to eat grains, eat rice, unpolished rice, avoid meat at all costs, eat natural fruit, eat the fruit in the season, and so forth. Don't try to preserve things beyond their time. You eat what is appropriate. And macrobiotic regimes are available in Korea today, and people actually still follow them. I remember when I first went to Korea in 1970, I was told on these days of the calendar, you have to change your diet. So we have something mixed in with nuts, and other time we eat only rice cakes and so forth. And we'd be constantly changing the diet based upon the turning points of the agricultural calendar. Breath control, a practice within Korea introduced under Taoism. Breath control is learning to literally, learning to actually control the autonomic reflexes of your own breathing and the resultant blood pressure. I actually was trained by a Taoist practitioner in Korea that I can actually make my heartbeat slow down. I know how to concentrate and get to a level where I can make the heartbeat slows down. I like to do that once in a while when I'm lying in bed next to my wife because she can't feel my heartbeat anymore. But the purpose, of course, is to conserve energy, to make your autonomic reflexes very natural and soft and so forth. And then, of course, also medicine. Taoist medicine was introduced into Korea. Koreans actually picked up on this, and they learned to do all kinds of things. Again, very important. Acupuncture is based upon Taoism. Various massage therapies is based upon Taoist, Taoyin gymnastics. A lot of medicinal practices that Koreans today, as well as Chinese and others, practice are really based upon the idea, the Taoist notion of the body, how the body operates, how its energy channels operate, and so forth. And these, again, Koreans picked up. They didn't pick up Taoism exclusively because they were also Buddhist and Confucian at the same time. But they did learn from the Taoist tradition and actually put into practice. One other thing to remember about Confucianism and Taoism is actually that in the early years, there were very few, probably no people who were exclusively Confucian or Taoist, or for that matter, Buddhists. The earliest teachers of Chinese tradition within Korea were actually Buddhist monks and nuns. Very educated people who went to China, studied Buddhism there, brought back the texts and rituals, but they also brought back to Korea knowledge of Confucianism, knowledge of Taoism. There's a very interesting anecdote that in the 13th century, there was a young man who wanted to know what the Book of Mencius was about. He went around to all the Confucian scholars, and they'd never heard of Mencius. They had never read the book. But then he went to a Buddhist monastery, and the Buddhist monk there actually could explain the whole book to him. Right? So in the early periods, Buddhism, Confucianism, Taoism, these three religions were actually all mixed together. Buddhists taught Confucian texts. They taught Taoist longevity techniques. Confucians also studied Taoist longevity techniques, and they studied Buddhist scripture. There wasn't a kind of exclusivism between these traditions. And they actually interacted as a kind of cultural flow that affected everything from philosophy and poetry writing to general aesthetics. Okay. The third, and perhaps the most important of the early introductions, of course, is Buddhism. Of the three religions adopted from China, Buddhism perhaps has had the greatest and longest influence on Koreans. Buddhism originally, of course, is an Indian religion, but over the centuries had become very Sinified, that is, it had taken on the color and the flavor and the understanding of the Chinese. It is from the Chinese that Koreans were introduced to Buddhist texts, rituals, and institutions. Okay, and in the process, Koreans, as they became more and more Buddhist, studied more and more texts, Koreans also became more and more Sinified, meaning they adopted many of the practices and ideas of China itself. It isn't a pure Buddhism of India that they adopted. It's actually a very Chinese understanding of Buddhism. One of the nature of Chinese Buddhism that Koreans adopted is really somewhat peculiar when talking about Buddhism, because the Chinese had adopted Buddhism with a very strong emphasis not on monks and nuns per se, but upon religious rituals dealing with Buddhist figures who could help you. Put it another way, the Chinese understanding of Buddhism was that Buddhism was a very practical religion, that if you went to a temple or a monastery and did the right ritual, you would acquire something. Buddhism gives you something. Monks and nuns may be interested in enlightenment, but by and large, most Chinese never really thought about Buddhism as a religion of enlightenment. They thought about Buddhism as a religion of ritual, in which you carry out the right ritual, you pray to the right bodhisattva, the right Buddha, then that Buddha or bodhisattva will give you something. It's a benevolent religion in which you pray for things or read scriptures and thus acquire things. When the Koreans adopted Buddhism, they adopted that form of Buddhism. They weren't interested in becoming enlightened. Most Koreans never knew what Zen meditation was or meditation. And in fact, most Koreans thought of Buddhism really as a religion that would help them overcome disease, get them through drought, various kinds of natural and man-made disasters, and that Buddhism would also provide them with good fortune, meaning if you did the right ritual in a Buddhist ritual, then in fact you would make money, or you could acquire power, or you could acquire status. This Buddhism, both in China and Korea, is what we often refer to as Mahayana Buddhism. That is, that it's the Buddhism not of the narrowly vowed bhikkhu and bhikkhuni, monk and nun. It's really the Buddhism of the masses. And Mahayana Buddhism in China and then later in Korea is really concerned with the masses. How are the masses, how are the large majority of people going to, in fact, be happy in the world? They're going to be happy in as much as they regard, honor, give service to Buddhist bodhisattvas, Buddhas, and so forth. Buddhism that was introduced into Korea in the second century also had put a strong emphasis upon the idea of mass welfare, that Buddhism is to be adhered to, understood, and propagated because it helps people in general. The welfare of the masses is a byword of Buddhism, especially Mahayana Buddhism. Why do you read Buddhist texts? Why do you engage in these rituals? You do so for the benefit of the many, not the individual. The idea that Buddhism is all about me, you know, navel-gazing me, I'm going to be enlightened and so forth for my sake, this is actually not present in Buddhism in North Asia. Buddhism is really about compassion for others, compassion for the community and so forth. So Buddhist activity, especially Buddhist missionary activity in Korea, really taught Koreans, reinforced the idea that what life is about is that one can be happy in as long as one is engaged with the masses. Literally, compassion towards others makes life better for everyone. And Buddhism, of course, taught people how to arrive at compassion, and compassion was largely a matter of mental adjustment. By reading texts, reading about stories of great Buddhist figures, one can see what is compassionate and how to deal with it. Buddhism also, of course, introduced what I would call magical rituals, rituals that could be carried out by Buddhist monks and nuns, suitably paid, that would somehow protect the nation. One of the great cultural artifacts, I guess, I'm going to deal with culture, sort of artistic history here. Are you going to deal with any of the sculptures of Korean history? No? Okay. Well, one of the great cultural artifacts of Korea is this beautiful stone cave that was produced in the 7th century in Southeast Korea. And it's an image of a Buddha sitting in a big, huge dome cave in the rock, in the mountainside. And he looks out over the Eastern Sea. And just at dawn, as the sun rises above the sea, it reflects in his little jeweled eye here, and it kind of spreads throughout the cave. And this was a manufactured Buddhist cave of the 7th century, but its purpose was primarily to protect Korea from invaders that might come from the south, the Japanese. And the point was that Buddha would face out towards the south and protect the country. Now, again, this has little to do with enlightenment, but it has everything to do with Buddhism. Buddhism is a religion that allows itself to be used to protect people, to give them what they need and want. And so Buddhism became very important, beginning in the 5th century all the way down to the 14th century, roughly 1,000 years. Buddhism was the primary religion of Korea. All the royal households that ruled Korea, all of the ruling elite in Korea were, in fact, adherents to Buddhism. In fact, Buddhism became so popular and so much a social institution that it was expected that everyone's second son would become a monk. And actually, in the 12th century, rules had to be established to prevent second sons from being forced into the monkhood. So almost two-thirds of the male population of Korea actually became monks. Not good. Not good for economy, not good for agriculture and so forth. And people had to sort of withdraw from that. People were very enthusiastic about becoming monks and nuns and so forth. Actually, the women becoming nuns was okay, but we didn't want men taken out of the military or taken off of the farm to, in fact, become that. Buddhism developed in Korea, again, from 3rd century on, and it really developed into what I would call a religion of the community. Yes, there were specific practitioners like monks and nuns, and they were responsible for interpreting scriptures. They were also responsible for carrying out rituals, but people themselves were really responsible for practicing Buddhism. They did it by reading texts, and again, the text business. Koreans just love to read texts. So Koreans learn to read Buddhist scriptures and recite them. They did so magically. I mean, this is quite frankly, they would read the text and thinking that if they read the text correctly, that something wonderful would happen to them. Okay? And maybe something did. We don't know. But they really believed that the texts themselves had a magical power that would be extended to them if they read them with piety. Right? Later on, Buddhism actually became part of the very structure of Korean government. That is, that Buddhist monks and nuns really became ministers of the state. They were paid a salary. They were responsible for carrying out all kinds of rituals that the state needed. They were also served as ambassadors, spies, and military. This is, again, unusual. Monks and nuns served in the military. They could protect the nation state by engaging in warfare, something we don't expect of Buddhists, but this did in fact happen. We also know that many Buddhists from Korea ended up in China, where they studied the newest developments in Buddhism and brought those texts and practices back to Korea. But they also brought back to Korea information about Chinese defense or information about Chinese economics. And thus they became, and again, reinforcers and propagators of Chinese means and so forth. All right? Let's move on. We've got 10 minutes. Okay. And talk about Christianity. Let's do it real quickly. Christianity, of course, entered Korea in the 18th century, primarily through the medium of books, and then later through Protestant missionaries. Christianity was very different from what Koreans had been exposed to in terms of religion, because it actually appealed to something Koreans had never heard of, something called God. Koreans, of course, believed in gods. There were gods everywhere. There were gods in mountains and streams and trees and all over the place. But they had never heard the idea that there was only a single God, a monotheistic God. And the only way the Koreans understood Christianity at first was they thought that Christianity was a form of Western Confucianism. Because Confucianism taught a single principle of authority in the sky, and Christians were constantly pointing to the sky to talk about God. So they thought that what Christianity was Western form of Confucianism. The early teachings of Christianity actually were quite happy to continue that view, and early Catholic missionaries in China and then Protestant missionaries actually used Confucian ideas to translate Christian ideas. Christianity, of course, is very much a religion of the individual. Individual responsibility is important. Particular faith and belief in the power of God or Christ is important. God and Christ are the one authority. All other rules, all other forms of authority are minor compared to the authority of God, the authority of Christ. In that sense, Christianity is very different from what Koreans had experienced in religious terms because it was exclusivistic. That is, to be a Christian, you had to believe in one set of authorities, one set of scriptures, and not adhere to anything else. Koreans, of course, in becoming Protestant or in becoming Catholic, they liked the idea of being Catholic or being Christian, but they didn't like the idea of being exclusively Catholic or Christian. And even today, they are not. I remember going with a group of Christian evangelicals out to the mountains, and while we had there was a revival meeting there and so forth, people were praying. In the afternoons, we'd go off to a local Buddhist temple and talk to the monks or nuns there and, you know, have a nice meal and so forth. So even in the modern period, people are not exclusively Christian. But Christianity, as it was introduced in the 18th century, later in the 19th century, really appealed to Koreans because it emphasized something that other religions had emphasized but actually never practiced, the notion of social equality. A good friend of mine, Don Baker, at the University of British Columbia, has analyzed 18th century documents in Korea to show why Koreans found Christianity in its Catholic form to be something worthy of their attention. It talked about the notion that all people are equal. All people are equal under God or under the universe, and therefore social class is irrelevant. People really have share among others, a basic nature, a basic issue, set of problems, a set of capabilities which allow them to address those problems, and a kind of infinite value. Christianity teaches the notion of the infinite value of the individual. And this appealed to Koreans very early on. Other religions like Confucianism and Buddhism and Taoism had said the same thing, but they weren't actually practiced that way. Because Korean society, at least since the 2nd century down to the 19th century, was a hierarchical society. People at the high end had more power and authority than people at the lower end. And so the interpretations and understandings of religion were very much tied to class. And Christianity appeared just at a time when Koreans were getting tired of classes. They wanted to get rid of the upper class, get rid of the lower classes, make everyone equal anyway. And so Christianity appealed. It came at just the right time when, in fact, Koreans needed it. A second issue that Christianity brought to the fore was the idea of science. Catholic missionaries or Jesuit missionaries in China and then later Protestant missionaries in Korea were all highly educated. That is, they had graduated from places like Harvard, Yale, McGill University, and so forth. And so as Christianity was presented, it was presented really as a kind of understanding of educated elite, highly educated PhDs and ministers who actually had studied science. And much of what the Koreans came to understand as Christianity, we would in fact refer to as modern-day science. So when Christian schools were established in Korea in the 19th century, then in fact people learned biology, they learned chemistry, they also learned mathematics, they learned a lot of things which Christians considered to be important for understanding scripture, but Koreans had never had any exposure to. The idea of general and universal education, oh, great idea. Confucius had said everyone should be educated. In fact, in Korea, only a very small group of the highest elite was educated. But when Christianity appeared, it said everyone should be educated. And so schools were set up primarily for discriminated minorities, lower income brackets, and women for the first time so that women could actually go to school. The oldest institutions for Christian education and general education in Korea that are the basis of modern day education were in fact schools for women so that women could learn to read and write and women could learn history and so forth. And also Christianity introduced the idea of subservience to the rule of law. Again, Christians believe that God is supreme, Jesus is supreme, but in fact Jesus also delegates to secular authority the rule of law, so you have to obey the law. And Christians have always said, you know, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, what unto God what is God. They've recognized that there are two authorities, that of Scripture and that of secular authority, and Christians have to be subservient to both. But it certainly helped that, in fact, Christianity also emphasized this in the 18th century. Right? Christians also, especially in the 19th century, emphasized the idea that nation states have a right to exist. So you can be Christian, but you can also be American. And to be a good Christian and to be a good American are not incompatible with one another. You can be Canadian and you can be Methodist. They're not incompatible. And in Korea, missionaries, especially the 19th and 20th century missionaries, actually promoted the idea that Korea had the right to exist at a time when the Japanese were beginning to create their great empire in Asia. And many of the earliest missionaries supported Korean national independence. 19 signers of the Declaration of Independence in Korea were actually missionary, what do you call it, converts to Christianity and Protestantism. So Christianity actually appears in Korea at the time when, in fact, Koreans need it most, and really introduces them to the modern world. Okay? I know only 5 more minutes, but just real quickly, want to deal with new religions. I'll talk a little bit about this after the break. New religions also have appeared, and new religions are, of course, appear in Korean history because they are needed. That is, that Koreans have to deal with both the past and the present. And one way of bridging the past into the present is actually the production of a new religion. Many new religions that have appeared in Korea since the 19th century, in fact, have been based upon the idea that all the old stuff is corrupt, all the old stuff is outdated. We need something better, something more dynamic, more adaptable to the modern day. Christianity is outdated. Buddhism is outdated. Confucianism, outdated. Let's get rid of that. We're going to create, in fact, the religion that will solve your problems today. New religions appear in Korea, and they are the product of Koreans. Koreans actually invent these religions. In 1970, there were luckily around 380. I think today there are close to 900 different new religions in Korea. Most of them are very small, but they are created by individuals. The important element of them is that they mix and match things. They take Confucian, Buddhist, Taoist, Christian, Muslim ideas, kind of mix them all together, and create a new kind of religious organization. One of the ironies of the new religions is that they are taught by one person who becomes the head of the community, and that person's whole purpose is to displace the authority of tradition. But then that person becomes the new tradition. So people adhere to this one person, and then, of course, upon his death or her death, then there's a question of whether, in fact, people will continue in the new religion. There is a great sense in the new religions that the past was good, that there was a golden age in which everyone in Korea was happy. And the new religion is a way of getting back to that past by bypassing history and so forth. And also new religions are very much tied up with ethno-nationalistic concerns. That is, a new religion appears to reaffirm our Korean identity in ways that Confucianism, Buddhism, Taoism, Christianity, Islam cannot affirm. So we are going to be the best of all Koreans by becoming members of a particular new religion. And examples of that are the Tonghakgyo, the One Chungsan-gyo, Wonpulgyo, Tanjin Hope Society. A lot of different religions promote themselves in the new modern period as the religions that are best adapted to the modern world. So we're going to take a little break for about, 10 minutes? And then we'll go on to talk about the modern world and how religions function within it. Okay? Thank you.
The opinions expressed in the preceding program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Korea Society, its staff, management, or sponsors. Thank you for listening to this Korea Society podcast. If you enjoyed it, please consider becoming a member. Visit www.koreasociety.org for information about memberships and to learn more about all the programs available at the Korea Society.